Good afternoon. House Education Finance Committee will come to order. Welcome, members. Glad to have you ever back today. Today we're going to finish with our overview of special education. We did not have time for Dr. Melcher to go through the formula change that was made recently and what that means. So we will start with his presentation, and then after we're completed with that and questions for him, we will then resume overview of the governor's budget proposal for education. And so that's our plan for today. But before we do that, Representative Poston, would you like to move the minutes for the February 1st meeting?
Madam Chair, I would like to move the minutes.
All right. So Representative Poston moves adoption of the minutes from February 1st. Any discussion? All right. Seeing none, all in favor of Representative Poston's motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Minutes are approved. Thank you, Representative Poston. All right. With that, Dr. Melcher, thank you very much for coming back today. We appreciate it. And if you would please just state your name for the record and provide your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Tom Melcher. I'm the Director of School Finance at the Department of Education. I have a PowerPoint that should be in your packet, and there are a couple of one-page tables from the last hearing that I'd also like to say a little bit about. I believe there are some extra copies being made of those. So, what I'd like to start with is just a very brief overview of the federal funding, which does interact with the state special education funding formula. Most of the federal aid that we receive for special education is in the form of the Part B Section 611 formula grants, which are for students ages 3 through 21. And last year we received $187 million in that program. It does increase this year to about $193 million. The second large pot of funding is called Part B, Section 619, and that's for children ages 3 to 5, and we received $6.9 million in that program last year, and we're receiving $7.2 million this year. And the third program is Part C, which is for children birth to age 2, and we're getting about $7.2 million in that program. It goes up to $7.6 million in the current year. This is the history of federal funding for special education. Back in the mid-1970s, when the federal mandate for special education was enacted and IDEA was first drafted, the federal government set up a goal of funding 40% of the excess cost of special education. They've never approached that number, and this gives you the trends over the years. We were around 8% in 1990, 10% in 2000. There was one year, 2010, where we received a doubling of the amount of aid. It was part of the federal stimulus money, so it was only one year. We were almost up to 30% that year, and then the next year it went right back down. So for 2016, we're about 12.7% funding from the federal government. In 2017, it's about 12.8%, so very similar. So whatever special education costs are not covered in federal aid, fall to the state to pick up. I wanted to say a little bit about the federal funding formula. The big one is the Section 611 funding, and that comes in two pieces. $55 million of that is allocated to Minnesota and to our school districts and charter schools within Minnesota based on the 1999 funding level. They did a change in their formula as well back in 2000. That's allocated based on the special ed child count in each school district from 1998, and there is an adjustment for newly opened or closed charter schools. So, for example, the Minneapolis School District receives an allocation based on its child count from 1998, and then we prorate the money between the school district and charter schools located in the school district based on their share of the current child count. The increase that's been provided since 1999 is allocated on a different type of formula. It's called a census-based formula, and of the amount of money allocated, 85% is allocated to school districts based on the total pre-K to 12 enrollment, including non-public school students, and 15% is allocated based on poverty counts. Poverty is included because the federal government recognizes that the concentration of special education students tends to be higher in school districts that have high poverty concentration. The funding formula for Section 619 is very similar, except it uses the age 3 to 5 count from 1996.
So, Dr. Melcher, I mean, so the counts go back to the 1998 child count, and those have not been adjusted?
Madam Chair, that is correct. So it's very outdated.
I did not know that. Thank you for providing that information.
Essentially, school districts that have had a lot of enrollment growth since then are underfunded, and school districts that have had declining enrollment since then are overfunded in terms of the special ed piece for the federal government. Now, it's only a small portion of the total. But.
All right, and I think Representative Mariani had a question.
Madam Chair, very quick questions. I should know this, but I don't. How does all this money come in? Does it come in under just a special ed, or does it come in as part of the other federal funds? What's the relationship with ESSA funds? Are those separate things?
Madam Chair, Representative Mariani, the federal special education funding is a separate allocation to the state of Minnesota. We receive a certain allocation for the year. So, for example, it's $193 million for this year. We don't draw the money down until the school districts have spent the money and they put in a reimbursement request. So we take the $193 million, we allocate it among school districts, partly based on that 1998 child count, but also based on the more recent data for the growth part. And then, so the school districts have a certain pot of money. They're allowed 27 months to spend that money.
Okay.
And so when a school district makes an expenditure, they report that to the department. They can draw that down every month as they spend the money. Sometimes school districts carry over part of that until the next year. We don't actually get the cash from the federal government until the school districts have reported to us that they've made an expenditure and they're ready to be reimbursed.
So the
Representative
Mariani. Madam Chair, so mechanically that's a process that just constantly siphons through or flows through the Department of Education, right? So that's a direct relationship with the district, with our department, that then is bringing in and holding the funds and then distributing, right?
Madam Chair and Representative Mariani, yes. We get notice from the federal government about how much money there is going to be available. We tell the school districts, here's your maximum amount for this year, and then the cash actually flows. When they tell us they've spent the money, we do a draw of cash from the federal government at the time that we're going to pay it out to the districts.
And one final
question,
Madam Chair. And Mr. Melcher, so we often hear that Minnesota has certain special ed standards that exceed federal required standards of delivery of service. Have we ever disaggregated what the costs of those are?
Dr.
Madam Chair and Representative Mariani, I'm not aware of any separate calculation that's done that would say, here's how much it would cost in Minnesota if we had the same standards as the federal
level. Okay. All right. Thank you.
All right. Other questions? All right. You may proceed, Dr. Melcher.
So, Madam Chair and members, I'd like to move to the next slide, which begins to talk about state funding in Minnesota. And the first thing I'd like to say about special education funding is that special education students are part of the overall student count for the district. They get the same general education aid as every other student in the district. And special education funding is really supposed to only cover the excess cost of special education. The general ed money is also covering part of their education. And, in fact, most special education students are spending a large part of their day in the regular education classroom, and the general education aid mostly goes to pay for those regular ed costs. The special education funding mechanism that we currently have has four parts. The first is the initial special education aid, which goes to all school districts that have expenditures for special education and charter schools and cooperatives. We also have excess cost aid, which is attempting to target money to districts that have relatively high costs for special education. That piece has a deduction for general education revenue, so it's targeted to districts with costs above a certain level. Then we have tuition adjustments, and state law makes the resident school district responsible for the unfunded cost of special education. And so when a non-resident district is serving, a school district's children, or when the children are placed in an intermediate district or a cooperative, there is a tuition bill that goes back to the resident school district to help cover the unfunded costs. I'll get into that in more detail in a moment. And then finally, the new funding formula that was enacted in 2013 has a hold harmless provision and a growth limit. The hold harmless provision ensures that every school district will receive at least as much funding under the new formula as they received under the old formula. The growth limit puts a cap on the amount of growth a district can get on the new formula compared to the old formula. And again, I'll go into the details of that. So let's talk about the initial special education funding. And the initial special education funding is based on the least of three calculations. The first calculation is to take 62% of the school district or charter schools, what we call old formula special education expenditures from the prior fiscal year. I'll define old formula, but the main thing you need to know is it excludes the fringe benefit costs. Those didn't used to be covered under the old formula. They are covered now under the new formula. The second calculation is to take 50% of the district's non-federal special education costs for the prior year, which is all of the special education costs, excluding what's paid for by the federal aid that the district has received. And then the third formula is a pupil-driven formula, which is somewhat like the federal formula, except we don't use 1998 data. It's based on 56% of the amount calculated using the pupil-driven formula for the prior year. And again, I'll explain that in more detail. And then in addition to that initial amount, we also pay for 100% of the special transportation costs, including bus depreciation on special vehicles, for example, vehicles that have a wheelchair lift, again, based on prior year data. It does not cover transportation costs for students with disabilities that don't require special transportation, only those that require a special additional cost like an aid on the bus, a wheelchair lift, or something like that. So getting a little bit more detail on this pupil-driven funding formula. What this formula does is it takes the data on special education students and cost and breaks it down into four funding levels that are based on cost. And so funding level one is directed at the higher incidence, lower cost programs such as speech therapy as an example. And this particular piece of the funding is allocated based on a total child count for the district, or a total enrollment for the district, rather than a special ed count. So it's like the federal formula that's based on total enrollment in the district. And so the way this formula works, it funds 56% of an amount per ADM that's the sum of $450 plus $400 times the free and reduced lunch percentage. So if you had a typical district, you had 25% free and reduced lunch, that would increase the rate by $100. And then it also adds 0.008 times the district's ADM. So if you're a district that has 1,000 ADM, that would be another $8 per ADM. So it's somewhat following the federal theory that we're going to allocate money on a block grant based on the number of students enrolled in the district. We're going to allocate more money for districts with high poverty concentration because we know there's a correlation between poverty. And we're also going to allocate a little bit more money to really large districts because we know there's a tendency for larger districts to draw more special education students because of the services that are available. So that's for the high incidence, lower cost programs. And then we have funding levels 2, 3, and 4.
Representative Thiessen.
Why is there a correlation between poverty and special ed?
Dr. Melcher.
Madam Chair and Representative Thiessen, I'm not sure of the reason. We just know statistically that that's the case.
Representative Mariani.
And quickly, but I suppose this will be a question for all the other formulas. How often, when do these formulas get tweaked, and how often does that happen? Do we do that through legislation? Is that done administratively? Just give us a sense of how that happens and how often.
Madam Chair and Representative Mariani, the state of Minnesota has historically funded special ed on a percentage reimbursement formula. That only changes when the legislature decides to change the formula. So When I started working at the department a number of years ago, it was a straight percentage reimbursement. Then we had some budget problems, and the state took the percentage reimbursement and applied a statewide cap. So in 2013, when we changed the formula, that was the legislature that made that decision, we were prorating the percentage reimbursement model in the 85 to 90% range because of the statewide cap that was imposed. There was a working group that was created in 2012 at the request of the governor that made a number of recommendations for school finance changes. One of them was to change the special education funding formula. That was picked up by the governor in the 2013 session. And at the compromise at the end of the legislative session, it was agreed to move to this different funding approach. Now, current law does have a provision in it that requires the department to report annually on what the average cost per pupil is for each of these funding categories. And when the legislation was enacted, I think the legislature realized that we may want to be coming back and revisiting, do we have the different disabilities in the right cost categories? Is the cost accurate? There was some concern that because we had not been using the data in terms of student cost by category to drive funding in the past, that we might have data being cleaned up over time. So part of what I'm going to do today is present a report that was required by the legislature in 2013 that every odd-numbered year we tell you what the most recent data is on the cost by level to give you information that's needed to determine if we should be tweaking that.
Representative Mariani.
I think I'm good. I'll follow up on this. Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you.
So, Madam Chair and members, the current legislation, and this is just for this one pupil-driven part of the formula, is dividing the higher cost, lower incidence funding into three groups, and it was really calculated based on the data we had for 2013, actually 2012 at the time that the formula was created. So, funding level two provides $10,400 times the district's child count for autism, developmentally delayed, and severely multiply impaired student. That was based on the average cost for those three disability areas per child served back in 2012, adjusted for inflation to try to get up to a 2016 number. We also provide in funding level three, 18,000 times the number of students who are deaf, hard of hearing, or have emotional or behavioral disorders. Again, based on the average cost back at the last time we had data. And then $27,000 times the number of students of disability areas of developmentally cognitive mild moderate, developmentally cognitive severe profound, physically impaired, visually impaired, and deaf blind. So we have these four funding levels created based on the data from 2012 with the requirement that we report to you periodically on how the data looks now. And toward the end of the document, I will provide you with an update on that.
Representative Dabney, do you have a question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Dr. Melcher, you probably said this, but I think my head was spinning at the time, so I didn't hear you quite well. But when you say, you know, 18 times, or excuse me, on these funding levels 2 through 4, mm-hmm. X amount of dollars times the district's number, is that the number that's calculated in level 1 and then that carries through, or is it the raw number of students meeting these in these different categories?
Dr. Melcher.
Madam Chair and Representative Dabney, level one is completely separate. That's just a block grant of money to cover the cost of the higher incidence, lower cost. So for these levels, we're looking at the December 1st child count in those specific disability areas.
Madam Chair.
Representative Dabney.
So a student diagnosed with autism would not generate any monies under level one, but would exclusively under level two. Am I understanding
that, Madam Chair and Representative Dabney, that is correct, although the district can, it's a pot of money they get, they can decide to allocate it.
Sure.
But so in terms of the money that actually gets generated, a student with autism would be in funding level two. They would generate $10,400 times this 56% reimbursement ratio as this part of the formula.
Madam Chair, just one last brief question.
Representative Dabney.
Thank you, ma'am. What about the child who has multiple diagnoses? that span these different
Madam Chair, Representative Dabney, the children are identified with a primary disability, and that's the one that we use.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Representative Mariani.
Madam Chair, very quickly. So this is all about money that's generated, so you have these categories.
Mm-hmm.
But did you say that a district then can, I just want to make sure I understand it. So if you're generating level two for students with autism, it's all one big pot of money. Can a school district then redirect those particular funds elsewhere?
Dr. Meltzer.
Madam Chair and Representative Mariani, we have one categorical for special education. A school district can only use that money for special education, and we don't have any districts that are fully funded for their special education costs. So we don't require the money in level two that's generated to be spent on level two.
Got it.
That's up to the district. They get one big pot of money for all their special ed costs, and they decide how to allocate it. This is just a mechanism that's used to try to get some fairness in the distribution of funding based on the types of students the district is serving.
Okay. Thank you.
And Dr. Meltzer, on these funding levels, was this developing these? That was part of the work of the task force that the governor convened? Or was, I'm assuming there were surveys done of schools and trying to pull some numbers on costs per the students and these categories?
Madam Chair, the department had that data already, and so we used the data that we had in order to calculate that. And this actually might be a good time if you have a copy of this other table that I'm not sure if that's been distributed.
It's
labeled Special Education Program Sorted by Funding Level.
Yes, everyone should.
Let me walk through that one right now because I think this is the update. So we're required by statute to present this information to you every odd number year for your budget deliberations. And so what this table shows, the left-hand side are the different primary disability areas. We have the disabilities in cost level four at the top, and then we work our way down to the lower cost levels. So for the highest cost level, you can see the five categories that are included there. And we have also shown you what the child count is for each of those, what the cost was that was reported in UFARS directly for the staff in those disabilities. We also, down at the bottom, you'll see $213 million in 2013 that was for indirect cost of special education. That includes things like director salaries, cost of staff who serve three or more disability areas that can't be identified in one particular area. So what we did is we take the costs that are directly charged to each disability, and then we prorate that $213 million across all the other ones based on the number of students in each category to come up with that total cost per child, which is in that fourth category. So for the highest cost category, developmental cognitive disability, severe, profound, the average cost was $46,084 in the 2013 school year. And you can see how that varies. It's kind of rank ordered from high to low, and this is how districts have actually reported the data in UFARS and divided by the child count they give us on December 1st each year. The right-hand side of the chart shows you the same information, but for 2016. So this just became available a few weeks ago. So now, in the case of developmental cognitive disability, severe, profound, we have about the same number of students. It's about 2,000 students. The cost has grown from $91 million to $96 million, and the average cost is now $50,624. So that's a drop of 3% in the number of kids and an increase of 9.9% in the cost per student in that particular category. So looking at this report, you can see what the change has been in each of the areas. So, for example, deafblind has seen a significant increase, a 31% increase, but it's really low numbers. We went from 63 kids to 83. You can also see that there are some areas that have experienced significant increases in the cost per student. So if you go down to developmentally delayed, which is about two-thirds of the way down the that's the early childhood program. And you can see that we've grown from 15,000 to 16,000 students, but that the cost has grown from almost 9,000 to about 12,000, or about 37%. And so That may indicate that we're doing more intensive services for children preschool, maybe because we've got some of the preschool programs operating that are identifying more of these disabilities earlier and providing more service to that age group.
I think Representative Erickson has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Melcher, do these costs, just looking at 403, the developmental cognitive disability severe profound, do those costs include what a district would pay to hire an aide for that child? Or is this just the educational cost without the addition of a para?
Madam, Dr. Melcher.
Madam Chair and Representative Erickson, it would include special education paras that are working with
thank
it. So it's all of the cost.
Oh, thank you.
Except for any cost that's been reimbursed by federal
yes.
funding.
Thank you.
All right. Please continue.
So, Madam Chair and members, the one of the things that we wanted to do with this analysis was to say, well, do we think we still have the programs in the appropriate categories? And based on our analysis of this, the department did not recommend any change in terms of what the funding levels are. So the programs in at the top group, the funding level four, are all still the highest cost programs except for deaf-blind is a little bit lower, but we think there may be some underreporting of the cost there, so we don't recommend moving it just based on 1 year of improved data. You can see that the next cost level, the EBD and the deaf hard of hearing, again, comes in lower than the cost level four, but higher than the other group. So we think that the alignment of these into the categories is pretty good the way it is, and there's no need to change the law as it relates to what group the students are placed in for this this purpose. One thing that the department did recommend based on the results of the study is some realignment of the funding rates if the legislature were to choose to make those more consistent with what the costs currently are. And if you look at the bottom of the chart, we've summarized the data by funding level, and so the average cost per child for funding level four was about $29,000, $20,000 for funding level three, $13,000 for funding level two, and about $8,600 for funding level one. I don't know if you have your report, this longer report that we had yesterday handy, but I can just speak from what I've got. I don't think you need to have that necessarily, but
yeah, I think they were in the packets yesterday. I don't know how many people saved them, but if anyone needs one, we can try to get them.
Let me just
a quick
Mariani?
Quick question. So, again, before you dive into that, so this is reporting state appropriations for special ed. So we're not looking at numbers of expenditures that school districts are doing with their other sources of fund, because obviously there's a cross subsidy going on here. Would you expect that the pattern would be the same nonetheless? So I see the use of this as an analytical tool. Mm-hmm. So your example, developmentally delayed, that can generate a lot of discussion, you know, for us about the impact of policy, et cetera. But what I don't know as a result of this is what a district may be doing over and above what we're appropriating. So do I need to just go to each district to find that out, or is there a way that the department can kind of guess whether those patterns are similar to these patterns?
Madam Chair and Representative Mariani, this is based on the total cost. It's not based on just the state aid that we pay.
Oh, it is total cost.
This is what it actually costs to serve these kids.
My bad. All right.
And we're paying a percentage of that.
Got it. Thank you. Yeah.
Okay. So, Madam Chair, the report that I had, I also presented in the policy committee the other day, and you've got a copy of it for your records. Essentially what we did is we took the results of this and we said if we went to the formula in the statute and we went to adjust it, how would we change those numbers? And let me just go back to, let's see here, this part of the formula. So the first part of the formula is providing this per pupil rate. If we were reconstructing this based on the current data, what we would do is change the $450 to $467. We change the $400 to $415. On that page, And then on the next page, we would change the 10,400 to 12,700. We'd change the 18,000 to 19,000, and we would change the 27,000 to 27,200. And what that would do would be to align the funding level so it reflects the current average costs, adjusted for the fact that these are based on a fiscal 16 base year that gets adjusted. So there's some complicated adjustments to it, but those are the adjustments to the pupil-driven formula that would be needed if you were trying to keep this current in terms of the data.
And Dr. Milcher, could you repeat those figure adjustments? I think people were trying to write them down.
Yes, Madam Chair. So back on this page, the 450 would become 467. The 400 would become 415. The 0.008 would stay the same. On the next page, I'm not a high-tech person.
Neither is the chair. There we go.
We need some middle schoolers.
We need a millennial. Help us.
My apologies for this.
There's a question, Madam Chair. I can take that while we're...
Yes, Representative Thiessen.
Thanks. So, two questions. Sorry. First, the funding level, 10.4 initially, level 2. That would increase by 4.6% every year, so that's actually a different number today?
Madam Chair, Representative Thiessen, the 10,000 number is what we funded that at in fiscal 16, and then we automatically inflate that by 4.6% a year. So what we're really trying to do is say, well, if we take the 10,000, apply the 4.6%, how does that compare to what the new data would show for the same years?
So you've already incorporated those
yes.
since 13?
Yes.
Okay. And then the second question, this is, I'm sorry.
That's right, Representative Thiessen.
But you said we only... do a portion of this from the state, so the 10-4, is that multiplied by a certain percentage then?
Dr. Melcher.
Madam Chair, Representative Thiessen, we're using 56%.
Well, so that 56%.
Yep, the 56%, I'm sorry, carries through all of those.
Thank you.
I just kind of quickly constructed this last night, so I didn't get that.
No.
Okay. So, right. Madam Chair, shall I continue?
I think... Oh, wait, I'm sorry, we didn't get through all of the numbers.
So on this page, we have the 10.4 would become 12,700. The 18,000 would become 19,000. And the 27,000 would become 27,200.
Okay.
And I would also like to add that as part of the governor's review of this information, he decided to include those changes in his recommendation. It's a relatively small part of the funding increase he's proposing for special education. I believe it's in the $2 million range. But when your governor's bill comes out, you'll see that as part of it.
I'm glad you asked that, because that was my question, was if these number adjustments comprise the $40 million, or this is a small part of that?
That's a small part of it, Madam Chair. And I can, as we walk through further parts of the formula, I can explain where else the governor is recommending changes.
Thank you. All right. I don't see any other questions right now, so we can continue.
So, Madam Chair, I'd just like to get into a little bit more background on what we term to be some of the non-federal versus the old law formula here. So non-federal special education aid essentially just means it's the cost of special education, excluding what's reimbursed with federal funds. It also excludes the cost of general education aid paid for students who are served mostly outside of the regular classroom. So if a student's in a Level 4 program, none of that general ed aid is going to pay for a regular classroom teacher. We also subtract that off in terms of calculating the non-federal cost. It also excludes transportation because we've got 100% separate reimbursement for transportation. We don't pay for buildings with special ed aid, and we don't pay for OPEB, post-employment benefits. The old formula, special education cost, that we used to use and that we still use and hold harmless, is based on the salaries of essential personnel. So the key thing there is no fringe benefits were covered. And it also covered contracted services and instructional supplies and equipment. So it was more of a narrow definition of what the costs were that were allowed. Statewide, the old formula cost is about 78% of the new formula cost. Here are the differences between the old formula cost and the new formula cost, and it's largely employee benefits. So this would be the teacher's retirement, employer contribution, the Social Security, the health insurance benefits for the special education teachers. And that was not covered under the new formula. It's part of the new definition of special education cost. Special education administrators were not covered under the new formula. That's about $6 million. There were some costs for transition disabled programs that were not covered. They paid for teacher travel and some other things that were not under the old formula. And then you can see some smaller things like dues, equipment communications, postage. So $380 million, but mostly it's the difference between the two definitions is including fringe benefits in this current definition. So what the way school districts used to do this, the state didn't, you know, only paid for the salaries, no fringe benefits, and we wouldn't pay for like the special ed director's salary. So what the school districts would do is they'd take their $190 million of federal special ed money and they'd use that to pay for the director's salary and for as much of the fringe benefits and so forth as they could cover. And then they'd use the state money to cover the things that were allowable for state aid. So we really haven't changed the game. You know, the state didn't cover the director's cost, but the school district still got reimbursed. They just used their federal aid for that instead of the state aid. So moving to the next slide, we have a second component of the formula called the excess cost component. And this has been part of our formula for many years. And the idea is that we target aid to school districts that have relatively high cost. So maybe you've got, you know, students, the cost is much higher than what we're covering under the initial formula. What the state does is we pay a percentage of the cost that's not funded with the initial formula that exceeds a certain portion of the general education. So the idea is we're trying to hold down the cross subsidy. We assume districts are going to have to cross subsidize some. We're trying to target some additional aid to the districts that have high cross subsidies. So again, we have two formulas here, and I want to say that the working group didn't recommend two formulas. That was kind of a compromise we had to do. The working group recommendation would have cost about $125 million a year to basically eliminate the old formula, go to the new formula. And because when we made the change, we had about $40 million, we had to keep the old formula in place because there are quite a bit of differences among school districts in the ratio of fringe benefits to other costs. And so in order to make sure we didn't have any losers, we keep the two formulas in place. So currently what we're paying on is the greater of 56% of the difference between the unreimbursed non-federal cost and 7% of the general ed aid, or 62% of the unreimbursed old formula cost and 2.5% of the general ed aid. So typically what happens is that districts that have relatively high special education costs, they're going to be funded on the first formula. And districts that have relatively low special education costs are funded under the second formula. The working group would have recommended eliminating the second formula, but because of the funding constraints, that would have created a number of losers among the lower cost districts, and so we kept that part of the formula in place.
And Dr. Melcher, do you know how many districts are reimbursed under the first versus the second?
Madam Chair, I have that, but I don't have it with me. I could get that to you.
Thank you. Representative Mariani.
And Melcher, quickly, generally the determining factor between a high and a low, is that a demographic? As a result of a demographic with the student population, or is it as a result of something else? Or is it not that simple?
Madam Chair and Representative Mariani, it gets complicated. It depends on where the students live that have the high-cost disabilities. And typically what we see is that central cities have higher costs, and I'm talking about not just Minneapolis and St. Paul, but St. Cloud is an example. Places that are regional magnets where families that have a child with severe disabilities, they're going to move there in order to access the services because they've got the programs. But also in some rural districts, you see some, you know, you've got one kid that's a $50,000 kid or an $80,000 kid, that can tremendously affect their cost per child. So it does vary across the state, but in general, you have higher costs in the metro area, in part because of higher salaries for special ed teachers, and higher costs in the larger districts that have more comprehensive programs.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is a really ignorant question, but do you help the districts calculate some of this? Because I would imagine in their UFAR system, it's like campaign finance. I know my treasurer puts in the amounts, and it kicks back if it doesn't qualify. And does that happen then in school districts too for the UFARs?
Madam Chair, we do all the calculations for the school districts. They just tell us the count. So the way our reporting system works is we have a system called EDRS. The districts report each of their special ed teachers and what their salary is, and they report their student data. We go through the calculations. And at the end of the year, we compare their UFARS reporting to what they've told us in EDRS.
Sure.
And if they're way off, we actually pay them based on the lesser of the two. We send them a report that says, you know, double check because you're not, your UFARS doesn't say that you're spending as much as you told us. And then we give them some time to clean that up.
Thank you.
So, Madam Chair, that brings us to tuition reimbursement, which is the most complicated process.
So we're done with the easy stuff, is that?
Yeah, we're done with the easy stuff now.
Okay.
So historically, we would calculate the special ed aid. The resident school district would then pay a tuition bill that they pay to the serving district or the co-op. Historically, the co-op or the serving district calculated the tuition bill and sent it to the resident district, and we'd get involved in disputes because they'd be all over the place in terms of the data. So back about 10 years ago, the legislature passed a law that said, Department, you've got all the data anyway. Why don't you just do the calculations? So now we do the calculations, and we tell the districts how we've done the calculations for tuition. And also the law has changed over time, where for students that have open enrolled, the resident district is now responsible for 90% of the unreimbursed cost. It used to be 100%. And the serving district or charter school is responsible for 10% of the unreimbursed cost. We do have an exception to that. If you're in a charter school with a concentration of special ed students or more, of more than 70%, then you still get 100%. So in other words, if you're at Metro Deaf, you're going to get 100% reimbursement. You don't have any general ed kids to cover the shortfall from, so we make an exception for Metro Deaf and Lionsgate and Frazier, the three that are in that situation. So also a change that was made with the new formula is historically we used to fund only the school districts. And we required the co-ops and intermediates to allocate all their costs back to the school districts. And then we didn't pay the intermediates anything. They got all their money from tuition billing. And that created some severe cash flow problems for the intermediates because they had to wait for the tuition to be calculated before they could get paid anything. So we cut out two steps of paper processing by saying, intermediates, just tell us what your cost was. We'll calculate the aid, pay you, and that might cover 50 or 60% of the cost so they get better cash flow. And then we settle up at the end on the tuition billing part. And then we get to the last part of the formula, which is the hold harmless and growth cap. And so as part of the change, we knew we were changing the data. So the legislature had us put a provision in that says nobody gets less money under the new formula than they got under the old formula. There's very few districts that do. It's like a handful of small rural districts where the data can jump around a lot. But we guarantee nobody gets any loss. We also limit the growth over the old formula to $80 per pupil based on the 2016 data. So we didn't want to have any huge windfalls as a result of changing the funding. We wanted the $40 million that was put in to be distributed fairly across the state, so we put a cap on the amount of growth that you could have. The hold harmless and growth provisions continue in future years, but we inflate the base by 4.6%. So we don't recalculate the old Formula 8 every year. We just adjust it for inflation. I think I don't need to go into the details of the hold harmless. That might be too much. On the growth side,
Dr.
I think it's
Milford,
important.
I think we've got another question. Representative Slocum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm on slide 13, and I just have a quick question. It says the resident district responsible for reimbursing the serving district or charter school for 90% of the unfunded cost of special blah, blah, blah. The pass-through, is there any problem with, like, cash lag? I would think there would be. Why doesn't the money follow the student in this case rather than a pass-through?
Madam Chair and Representative, so in order to try to address cash flow for the resident and serving districts, we pay out the money through the course of the year. There are 24 payments, you know, twice a month throughout the course of the year. So school districts are getting roughly 60 to 70% of their cost covered by the state and federal aid that's flowing out throughout the year. We also make estimates of what the tuition bills will be, and we make some partial payments based on those tuition bills. So they're not waiting for the whole tuition bill until the end of the year. But those can be a little bit dicey. You have to have the student data. There's a lot of moving parts in this formula, as you can see. And so we do flow that out periodically. And, you know, we notice that, for example, new charter schools can have some issues with cash flow because they're relying on the tuition payment for a significant chunk of the money. They don't have large fund balances. So what we try to do is encourage them to get their data in on a timely basis. We find that during the first half of the year, we're underpaying a lot of charter schools because they haven't reported all of their teachers. So therefore, we don't know what their costs are, and we're only reimbursing them for the ones that they've reported. Then we do catch-up payments as soon as we know, but we just try to encourage them to get the data in as early as they can.
Representative Slocum.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Okay, but a charter school is supposed to be considered a district in and of itself. So I'm having a hard time defining district here when it goes through the traditional district for the charter to get the special ed funding.
Madam Chair.
Dr. Melcher.
And Representative, we do treat a charter school like a district. So a charter school will report their cost of special education. Let's say they're spending $1 million on special education. They tell us all of the teachers that are behind that $1 million. We pay them their special ed aid directly. It covers about $600,000 to $700,000 of their cost. Okay? Then they're going to get tuition billing to cover 90% of the difference. So let's say that the state aid covered the $700,000 they got paid directly. They're going to get tuition billing for 90% of the other $300,000. So $270,000 is going to come through tuition billing. It's the same for a regular school district that's serving non-residents. So you've got a resident of St. Paul that open enrolls to South St. Paul. South St. Paul is in the same situation with regard to the tuition billing. So we just try to get it done as quickly as we can. At the end of the year, we hold up a little bit of the money in order to make sure we have the final data so we're not overpaying anybody.
Thank you. Representative Poston.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Director Melcher, you've referred to this 4.6% increase per year. Can you just explain that 4.6% and how you arrive at that number?
Dr. Melcher.
Madam Chair and Representative, the 4.6% is a statutory figure. It's in the law. It's the inflation rate that was used on the special education formula when we had a cap on special education aid going back to the mid-2000s. So what we used to do is we would say you get a percentage of your cost covered, except we prorate if we are over the statewide cap. And the statewide cap was adjusted annually by 4.6%. The history behind that is that's been about the state average long-term cost growth for special education over the last several years. And it's a combination of more higher percentage of the kids being served in special ed and then just inflation in terms of the teacher salaries and maybe more kids served with more severe disabilities.
Representative Poston. Thank you. Okay. I think we've exhausted the questions for a moment, so we'll resume with the rest of your slides.
Madam Chair, I think I was on slide, let me go to slide 17. I was talking about the growth limits for fiscal year 2016. The growth over the old formula is limited to $80 per student. The that grows to $100 per student in fiscal 17, and then that is increased by $40 each year. So what this does is it kind of gradually phases in the new formula. If a district was being capped, that cap gradually goes away as that dollar amount per pupil increases. Madam Chair and members, the next slide, slide 18, shows the amount of money we have in each of the categories in 2016. The initial aid is by far the largest. That's the combination of that per pupil funding and the percentage on the old formula and the new formula. Excess cost aid, $250 million. Tuition adjustments, you see a zero there. That's because there's no net change, but it's about $200 million that changes hands between districts that are serving non-resident students. The growth cap reduces the aid by about $37 million in the current year, and the hold harmless is about $4 million, for a total of $1.2 billion that we're paying per year in special ed aid. And then the final slide is talking about this report. It was in your packets yesterday, and we kind of covered the table that summarizes that data. So, Madam Chair, that concludes my presentation. Unless you'd like me to go back and refer a little bit to some of the governor's recommendations and how they compare to the current formula.
Okay, I think we've got a question, and then I will ask you to comment on that. Representative Juergens.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Director Melcher, just one quick question. The hold harmless provision that you talked about, is that going to be phased out or is that ongoing? I'm sorry if you mentioned that.
Madam Chair and Representative, there is no statutory phase-out date for that. So it continues until if a district does generate more aid, our expectation is it will gradually phase out as costs increase, because the district is guaranteed to get what they got in 2000 under the old formula in 2016 plus inflation. So we could have some lingering effects of that over time, but the legislation was not written to phase it out. We could do that. It would save the state some money, but then you'd have a few districts that get less money for special ed than they're currently getting.
Okay, thank you.
Representative. All right, other questions? Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Melcher, I know you haven't discussed this here, but you did in my committee, the policy committee. When a school district is sued, because you had that report on what it's cost districts, are they insured to cover those costs of a lawsuit?
Dr. Melcher.
Madam Chair and members, I'm not sure that I know the answer to that question. I believe that aid only covers costs that are not funded with any sort of insurance. But
so then Dr. Melcher, Madam Chair.
Representative Erickson.
Okay.
That would come out of their general fund.
I'm sure we're not paying them if it was already covered by insurance.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. All right. And then Dr. Melcher, if you could just comment about the governor's budget proposal, the $40 million for special ed and how that would.
Okay, let me go back to these earlier slides, Madam Chair. I'm doing this by memory.
Okay.
So we talked about the per pupil part of the formula and how that would change in the governor's bill. And then what the governor's proposal does is it goes into the, I'm sorry, I'm trying to find the right slide here. Here it is. It's the part that I'm just looking at the bill draft to make sure I don't miss anything. So, okay. I'm sorry, I'm a little slow. So, Madam Chair, in this first section, we have the three formulas that are currently being used, and the pupil driven piece is the 56%, but the rates per student in the back part of that are increased. And what we do in this part of the formula and the governor's recommendation is we eliminate the old formula part of the calculation. So it would become the lesser of the new formula cost or the 56% of the people-driven formula. So we're trying to do away with that old calculation to the amount we can. And then the next piece that changes is in the excess cost formula, Madam Chair.
Representative Thiessen.
Can we just get the number for each of these changes, too?
Yeah, is Dr. Melcher, do you have those? Or I know we're really close to having the bill ready for introduction, and then perhaps the details will be in there. But so, you know, Dr. Melcher, whatever you're able to give us now, and I know we'll probably be covering this again.
Yes, and Madam Chair, when we did the modeling on this, we put several changes in at once and didn't say, here's what it is for this item and here's what it is. You know, we could try to go back and run it one step at a time to do that, but we currently don't have the breakdown. I know for the one piece, it was a relatively small portion of the total, but I could get to that, but I don't have it.
Okay. Yeah.
So the next change, Madam Chair and members, just go back to the excess cost formula here. The 56% would become 57% on the first formula, and then the 2.5% subtraction for general education revenue would be reduced to 2.2%. So what we're doing there is giving a little bit of a bump to districts that are getting funding under both parts of the formula to try to even out the increases. And then the last change is in the growth allowance. The growth allowance would increase from $140 in 2018 up to $171. And then the annual increase after that would be $43 per pupil. So it's about a $20 million increase per year in special education aid. And what we did was tried to first reflect the newer data on cost based on that report. And then secondly, each of the different parts of the formula were enhanced a little bit in order to try to make the increase in funding pretty proportionate to the size of the cross-subsidy. So districts that have a larger cross-subsidy will get a larger increase than districts with a smaller cross-subsidy. And we do have runs available on the impact.
Okay. Thank you. And I'm sure you can send those when they're ready, but when we get more details on the budget document as a whole or the legislation. Other questions for Dr. Melcher on the special ed? Okay. If not, thank you very much. We really appreciate you taking the time to go through this. And we will turn back to a resumption of our discussion started with Commissioner Caselius on the governor's recommendation. So the governor's submission and agency overview. All right, and we're pleased to have the Deputy Commissioner Briner with us today, and then, of course, Mr. Uni. And are we good with our technology? Everything's, for the moment, everything's working?
Madam Chair, for the moment, I believe.
All right, very good.
We're going to knock
on wood. Wood, Madam Chair. Yeah.
All right, and so, members, you should have in your packet the...
Do we have these?
Oh, do we have copies for the members for those?
Yes, Madam Chair, I believe they've been provided in the members'
right,
packet.
The PowerPoint, okay, very well. Should have those. All right, so, Deputy Commissioner, welcome, and please go ahead and state your name, and you may proceed.
Thank you, Chair Loon, and thank you, members, for having us today. My name is Charlene Briner. I'm the Deputy Commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Education. I bring you warm greetings from the Commissioner, who would be here herself if it were not for a longstanding appointment in Washington, D.C. She is a member of the board of the Council of Chief State School Officers, and they have a board meeting, and so she's in D.C. But we are very happy to be here to dig into a little bit more of the governor's budget recommendations, specifically around MDE and the agency recommendations, and happy to be able to talk about the work that the staff at the agency does. So we're going to start out. You have probably seen this often. Our mission at the department is to lead for educational excellence and equity every day for everyone. That means that we serve in Minnesota 2,213 public schools, 55,000 teachers, and 842,000 students in pre-kindergarten through grade 12. So we have a large constituency that also includes policymakers, stakeholders, parents, and other members of the public. We have a number of major services that we provide, including implementation of the laws that this body passes, programs, guidance to educators about how they can implement those laws on the ground, technical assistance and professional development to teachers and school leaders, state and federal school aid and grants distribution, educator licensing, data collection analysis. I won't read through everything because you're capable of doing that, but there's a wide range of oversight and regulatory responsibility that we hold. I included in the presentation just a brief overview of the various divisions at the agency so that you can get a sense of the scope of our work.
Madam Chair and members, Adoshunika, Director of Government Relations at the Department, we can certainly provide a larger sheet for our organization structure so that it's in a more readable format. Apologies for the format.
Thank you, Mr. Rooney. Representative Murphy.
On the organizational chart, could you just point out the box that has library services?
Yes. If you will look to the middle box, you'll see the commissioner, and then you'll see a line to three assistant commissioners. The middle assistant commissioner, under that section toward the bottom, you'll see State Library Services. Assistant Commissioner Kevin McHenry, the Director of State Library Services in the State Library, and report directly to Commissioner, Assistant Commissioner Kevin McHenry.
Representative Murphy, did you have a follow-up?
Okay.
Okay. All right. I think we can go. We can proceed. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So who are we and what do we do at MDE? I thought it might be helpful, particularly for the newer members, just to pull out an example of a few of the divisions at the agency so that you can get a sense of the work that we do every day. Academic standards, we picked them first simply because they start with A, so we're going to start with academic standards. We have a small but mighty staff of specialists that help teachers unpack and implement the standards in schools. We have a reading specialist, a math specialist, social studies. Actually, we only fund a 0.5 social studies specialist, and then we get some funding from the Historical Society to subsidize that position. Physical education, we don't have an arts specialist. We do have science and STEM specialists. So those professionals really are doing some work to help teachers understand and master the academic standards and to help them inform and improve instruction in the classroom so that children are mastering those state-required academic standards. We have, because the staff is small, we do a lot of professional development using various technology. We also do a lot of training, and our staff does quite a significant amount of travel to schools and districts. School support. You've heard a lot about our school support division. I know that you heard about the regional centers and the other activities in school support. We provide support around continuous improvement efforts. We work very closely with schools designated as priority or focus under the waiver. We deliver professional development around teacher and principal development and evaluation, and we administer the QCOMP program, the state-funded QCOMP program. For those of you who may be new, the regional centers, I think there's a lot of interest in the regional centers, people often wonder where they are. They're not a physical structure. So they run through the co-ops, the service co-ops. And what the regional centers are comprised of are a small team of professional experts in curriculum, in standards, in instruction and professional development that work particularly with priority and focus schools, also with continuous improvement schools, and any other school that wants help. They, for instance, if a school is designated as priority, a team of specialists would go into the school, work with the identified leadership team, which often includes teachers, educational leaders, parents, other stakeholders, to do a SWOT analysis, to really kind of get down and take a really good look at where the challenges in a particular school may be. They do a deep dive around data. They rely on our data analytics team. They help the staff really understand how data can inform decisions, and then they help them develop a plan for turnaround in those schools. I often like to say that this is not a top-down model at all. They stand side by side and work hand in hand with schools on the ground. And the response to the regional center support has actually been quite remarkable in terms of how welcome the regional center staff are. We had one superintendent in a priority school. It's not an easy thing to be designated as a low performer. It doesn't feel really good, but she said within months it was the best thing that happened, that the regional center staff was really key to helping them develop a plan that worked for them. And we saw that particular superintendent school move from priority status to reward status, so we also know that it's generating some really important and demonstrable outcomes.
Representative Mariani.
Yeah, Chair, and thank you, Assistant Commissioner. So very quickly on the regional centers, how long have they been around? How are they supported? Are we doing appropriations directly here for that? Is that part of our base? And then what are the regions of the regional centers?
So the regional
Deputy Commissioner.
Representative, Madam Chair, Representative Mariani, the regional centers were started, I believe, in 2013. So we got a waiver in 2012. The regional centers, we started with three, and they were funded with federal title funds. So I believe Title II that allowed us to use them for school support. We did get an appropriation from the state to expand the regional centers. I would qualify I don't want to qualify the work, but I would say that the additional monies does not allow for the level of service that the original three centers provide. So they're able to do professional development. They're able to assist, but not the intensive level of support that the three centers that are using the federal funding dollars are providing.
Mm-hmm. Representative Mariani.
Yeah, Madam Chair, what are the regions? I know they're not physical structures, but
right.
There's a targeting, right, around the state? Or?
So the
Deputy Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative Mariani, the original three, we had the Northwest region, the Southeast, because I believe in the area of Rochester, and then Central. I don't have the exact geographic service area, but we can provide that to you. I'll ask Mr. Uni to make sure that you get that.
And then, Madam Chair, one final
Representative
question.
Mariani.
I know they haven't been around very long, but do we have any assessments, evaluation of the efficacy, even if it's qualitative information from districts, et cetera?
Deputy Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative, we actually do. So the first year we had some really compelling data just in terms of improvement. So, and I'm recalling this from memory, I don't have it in front of me, but approximately 70% of the schools that had worked directly with the regional centers had shown significant improvement and, in fact, enough improvement to be moved out of priority status.
Representative Mariani?
Thank you.
Thank you. Deputy Commissioner, just so I understand, they're not actual physical structures, but are the staff designated for in doing the work of the regional centers? They are located out in the field, or they are here at the department and then maybe go out into the field to work with schools?
Madam Chair, the staff, the regional center staff are actually housed, for lack of a better term, through the several service co-ops. So we contract with service, with the EXUs, with the service co-ops, and the staff works out of those offices, although it's rare to find them there. We do have one staff person at MDE who coordinates the activities and works closely with the regional center staff and the regional directors. But I should also say that the regional center staff in the co-ops are not MDE employees.
Very good. And how would you categorize sort of the expertise that those staff members bring? Or is it, and you know, reading specialists, you know, what kind of qualities or skills are have you found is been necessary and helpful for those regional center staff people?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate that question. It depends on the needs in the area. So we've seen a particular focus in certain regional center staffs needing an emphasis on English language learning. We've seen certainly literacy and ELA specialization. The staff has specialized expertise in that, so we have reading and ELA staff at all of the centers. We've got some staff that focuses certainly on math standards, so we're also seeing a need. One of the things that we would like to do if we were ever afforded the resources, there's increasing demand for support for teachers around professional development, data analysis. We do have data analysis staff. We see a need in some of our northern regions with high concentrations of American Indian students to really kind of unpack and help them with development around the specific needs to that community. But I think that's fair to say that we have focused first on English language arts, reading, and math, and also EL.
Thank you. Representative Murphy.
Madam Chair, Commissioner, are any of the people that, are they, any of them have private contractors?
Deputy
are
Commissioner.
They all EXU?
Oh,
people working for the EXU that goes out, or and who hires these people?
Deputy Commissioner.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Murphy. I believe that they are employees of the service cooperative. I am not, I believe that that's the case. I can double check for you, but I believe that they are actually hired by the service cooperatives. And then they go through intensive preparation and training with us on how to work with the regional center model.
Representative Murphy.
And then, Chair, Commissioner, are they then employees of the service cooperative?
Madam Deputy Chair, Commissioner. Representative, correct.
For a certain period of time?
Correct.
Representative Murphy.
Madam Chair, Commissioner, are they paid by the service cooperative fund or are they paid by the state of Minnesota?
Commissioner Brenner.
Madam Chair and Representative, money is appropriated that goes out by contract to the service cooperative. So it is state money that pays the salaries of the regional center staff in the service cooperative.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you.
Okay. And other questions? Commissioner Brenner, so the regional centers were started with, I think, is it Title I money? Or
Title II.
Title II? It was the federal money.
Title funds.
Yes. And to really help the priority of focus schools. Do you know how many priority or focus schools that have refused assistance from the regional centers?
Madam Chair, I don't have that number. We can certainly look. There are a number that do choose not to work with us or choose to work with us at varying levels. We have seen a greater uptake in participation and districts or schools taking full advantage in greater Minnesota than we have in the metro area, although I there are some first-ring suburbs that have also worked very closely. Brooklyn Park comes to mind.
All right, thank you. Yes, if you could provide that information to the committee, I'd be appreciative. All right, I think we can go ahead and proceed. Thank you.
I wanted to, thank you, Madam Chair, I wanted to talk a little bit about our data analytics team. This is an effort that we've actually taken internally to redeploy some resources. The commissioner often talks about when she first started and wanted to look at third grade reading data. We didn't have any centralized place to take a look at that. There was a little bit of information in standards. There was information down in assessment. There was information in various parts of the agency. So we recognized very quickly that in an ever more hungry environment for data to make decisions about instruction and to inform practices at the school level as well as for policymakers, that we needed a better sense of the data that we have. We're data rich, but information poor. So we needed a better sense of the data that we have and actually how to make sense of it, and then how to work with schools and educators about how to use that data to inform instruction. So it is a small but mighty group that is pieced together from a variety of sources, mostly federal funding that is actually going to be going away relatively shortly, or that has already ended that we found other ways to sustain. They provide a range of information and services about data and accountability, school finance, demographic data, discipline, early learning, special education, and others. We have also seen them pressed into service increasingly by schools. We send a great deal of data and information to schools and to districts, and they have become an invaluable resource to educators in schools to really help understand where they can focus attention or where there may be some gaps that they can make decisions. And then school finance, and I sort of feel like I shouldn't even talk about this particular group. When I follow Dr. Melcher, you can see the wealth of knowledge that he has, the asset that he is to the state, and not only because of his depth of knowledge, but because he's also a fine identifier of talent. He's brought on a number of really skilled individuals to help make sense out of the complex formulas and to help us achieve not only accurate but timely disbursement and monitoring of the large appropriations in state and federal aid that go to schools.
Thank you. And Commissioner Briner, I would say I won't name them out loud, but I was visiting with some school business managers this morning who were singing the praises of Dr. Melcher and his staff and asking that we look favorably on getting them more help. So so since I have you, I'll ask, how many FTEs work with Dr. Melcher in that department, and has that been fairly static, the same number for the last 10 years?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I believe, I don't have the number in front of me, I believe it's around 26 or 27 FTEs. He has experienced a number of retirements in recent years, and so I think that it's fair to say that thank you. It's actually 40. Some of those are federally funded employees. So I guess I was thinking of state-funded FTEs. Thank you for that. I think it's fair to say that it's been a challenge to recruit and retain qualified people at the department. They often come and learn a lot from Dr. Melcher and then can go to a school district and make substantially more. And so recruitment and retention is a challenge for us. That number has stayed relatively static, although a couple of years ago the legislature was had the foresight to increase the number of auditors on staff, and so we're able to audit a little more frequently, although quite frankly I think it's still the span between audits is still quite lengthy.
Thank you. And just one other question. So I know part of the governor's request is for technology upgrades. Is most of that related to the functions of this part of the agency?
I thank you, Madam Chair. The mainframe, the short answer is yes. But there's also additional improvements to be made around data protection, security, as IT threats become more sophisticated. There is some work to be done there. We're also migrating, just in terms of risk mitigation, we're migrating our, I don't want to use the wrong terms because I'm not a tech geek, but we're migrating to an off-site warehouse to maintain or to mitigate disruptions to service. But I think it's fair to say that the mainframe upgrades are a large part of it.
Okay. Thank you.
I have some slides further in the presentation that break down that for you.
Thank you.
Other responsibilities of the agency include school and community food and nutrition programs. We serve millions of meals, or we assist providers in serving millions of meals each year. Early learning services, as you are well aware, there's a range of programming from ECFE to ECSE to school readiness to Head Start to pre-K to early learning scholarships. Indian education, we have 19,000 to 20,000 American Indian students in the state, and we have an Office of Indian Education that's staffed with three people. Although we do have a director position that is vacant right now, the commissioner is in the process of making a final decision to fill that position since Mr. Olson went to MIAC. State Library Services, Representative Murphy, you'd be glad to know that we highlighted them. Student maltreatment investigations, we do intake and conduct investigations on any allegations of maltreatment that may come to us. Adult basic education to community service providers, as well as the Department of Corrections, which is the largest provider of adult basic education. Public school choice, including charters, PSEO, online learning, and we also provide services to the Minnesota Non-Public Education Council.
Representative Juergens has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Some of us also sit on one or both of the agriculture committees, and a question that I had come up in the Ag Committee a week or so ago, maybe you could help with. Do you know are there any programs where you are incented to purchase Minnesota-grown products for your food programs or purchase milk from Minnesota dairy producers? Or do you have any idea of how much of that is that the school lunch programs are purchasing from Minnesota company or farmers?
Commissioner Briner.
Madam Chair and Representative, thank you for the question. I cannot answer specifically with numbers. I can go back to our Director of Food and Nutrition Services. I know that we are a participant in the Minnesota Grown Initiative through the Department of Agriculture. I can't quantify what those numbers are. I know that there is also a large movement of farm-to-school programs that individual districts are involved with, and we do support that work, but we will look and find that information to give you some specifics.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Okay, I think we can keep moving on. Thank you.
Thank you. So I wanted to talk a little bit, thank you, Chair Luna, I wanted to talk a little bit about the agency budget, staffing trends, and mandates for our work. So the agency's operating budget is comprised of state and federal funds. The state portion of that is $22 million a year. And just to put that into context, approximately $8.8 billion in state education funding is appropriated. Of that, 0.5% goes to operate the agency. So it's a relatively small number. $22 million is a big number, but it's a relatively small fraction of the entire education appropriation. I wanted to talk a little bit about our staffing trends over time. If you look at this chart, you'll see since 2008, our state funding has decreased over time, and our federal funding has remained relatively flat. Just to put that in context for you, a little more than 10 years ago, the agency split was about 60% state funding and 40% federal funding. And that's flipped today. And that's not, as you can see, because we've received more federal funding, but it is because of a decline in state funding for the agency. We have tried to fill some of those gaps through grant funding and philanthropic funding to carry out legislative requirements, that is not sustainable, as you're well aware. And without additional funding to mitigate some of the cost drivers that are beyond our control, we could potentially be looking at eliminating 15 full-time employees. I wanted to talk a little bit about unfunded mandates to the agency. This committee talks a lot about unfunded mandates to schools, and we know that the result...
Representative Thiessen.
Just on that last chart, is that starting in 2009?
2009, yes.
And I assume it's not a flat line. I mean, showing as a flat line decrease.
Commissioner Briner.
Madam Chair and Representative Thiessen, I believe that, there were probably dips along the way, so that it is over time. I would assume, because I'm looking at 2008 and I'm not certain when the ERA funds came through. We can get that information for you. I don't have it. I do have it in a chart that shows year by year, that you can see, but I can tell you that it has been fairly consistent. When you look, it's been in the 52%, 53%, 54% range for federal funding.
Representative Thiessen, follow up? Okay.
And Madam Chair and Representative, again, I'm talking about the agency, the portion appropriated to the agency, so not overall education funding. So unfunded mandates. The unfunded mandates to the agency occur in a range of program areas. As you know, that creates challenges in the same way that it does for school districts by taking staff away from critical priorities and assistance to schools and teachers, and has often required MDE to secure outside funding to carry out key work. Some examples of this would be the, I've put a couple of them on the slide, the annual staff development report. We pay for that with $26,000 from Title II funds. QCOMP is a major state program with a large appropriation. It has never been funded with state dollars, so we're using school support funds through Title II to administer the state QCOMP program. And principal development and evaluation, really important work that is really investing in our school leaders. We funded the initial work of creating the model, working with stakeholders to do that, and implementing with $413,000 from the Bush Foundation. We also, I want to make very clear, I'm not here to say that we are not happy to be managing our budgets. We believe that it is our responsibility to always be looking at the way that we do our work and to always be looking at opportunities to be more efficient, more effective, and good stewards of public resources. MD has eliminated three leadership positions on the commissioner's leadership team. We've reviewed the work of every position in the agency by shifting costs to federal funds and other funding sources where it's appropriate. As you know, that there are some pretty strict parameters around the use of a lot of federal funding, and so we do that where appropriate and where we won't be making decisions that will reflect poorly on us. We have held vacancies or not filled positions, and we have sought outside funding to support our work. I wanted to give you a little bit of example of the cost of an unfunded mandate to the agency. So last session, there were 21 new grant programs totaling $35 million. Important grants to agencies and entities that represent high priorities for members of this body and important work that is supported by advocates and people that are working on behalf of our students. 10 were new grant programs and 11 were new named grants. That money flows through the agency but is subject to specific procurement and administrative requirements that are set forth both in statute and in rule. The only funding we got to administer new grants were $50,000 for the full-service community schools and $100,000 over 6 years to administer the counselor grants. Other than that, we administered 19 new grants in addition to existing grants with existing funds. To quantify that, that represents almost 2,100 hours of time for one FTE over the course of 8 months. So it created, as you can imagine, some additional pressures on our grant staff to meet the deadlines and to get the money into the hands of the entities that rightfully were waiting to get to work with it.
And Commissioner, if you, I'll call on you next, Representative Thiessen, but just so the committee can understand, what is the definition of a grant? Because I'm thinking of, for example, the voluntary preschool program where districts applied and, you know, were awarded. I mean, there was administrative money for the department, and that's all around $600,000, let's say. But those would not be considered grants under the, per the slide you're presenting right now. Is that correct?
Representative Loon, that's correct. We consider that aid payments, so we did not consider that into the calculations we did around the grants.
All right. So then what would be a grant? How would that be described and versus other programs you may fund?
Representative Loon, thank you for the question. I don't have the entire list in front of me, but I know there was a grant to the Santa Foundation. I know that there were grants to what are some of the others that were listed? They were specifically named grants that went to specific entities. So they passed through us but are still subject to the work around administrative oversight.
Okay. Mr. Oney.
Madam Chair, I have some of the information on hand of the grants that have gone on, whether they're competitive grants or whether they're named grants. Can certainly provide a list to the committee as well as a status update of some of the grants that have gone out. As Deputy Commissioner Briner was mentioning, there's a lot of new grants, so some of them are still being worked on. Luckily, we had some implementation dates to work with some flexibility there, but the workload is quite large, and so there are certain grants, for example, the Ag Educator grants that are for next summer that are still going out. Just in January, we started committing all the grants for the teacher-governed sites as well. So it is a long timeline upon which we work, but I can certainly provide the committee with an update on the grants that have gone out.
Thank you, Mr. Ernie. And Mr. Strom, did you have anything to shed?
Madam Chair, just in terms of distinction between grants and aids, and the department may want to speak more to this, but in general, if there's a formula and ongoing amount, it's going to be considered an aid program and not a grant program. So in other words, if something is written as $10 per pupil or something like that, or $1,000 per teacher, and it's ongoing, then that would be considered an aid program and not a grant.
Mr. Strom. And Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So how many grants do we have?
Mr. Uney or Commissioner Briner?
Madam Chair, Representative Thiessen. So as we mentioned, we were just focusing on the new grant programs, which is 21. There are a range of other ongoing grants that we have that are not necessarily new, but that were renewed last year or that are multi-year ones. Again, that's some information that I don't have on hand, but I can certainly provide that overall number with a named list as well.
Representative Thiessen.
It just seems like 21 new programs is a lot of new programs to be creating in a single year. And how, Madam Chair, how...
Representative Thiessen. Pardon me?
How big are these grants?
Mr. Ernie or Deputy Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative Thiessen, I can give you an example of some of the grant sizes. As you see on the slide, the total is around $35 million. So, for example, the counselor bill, the total funding was $12.133 million. 100,000 of that was for administration, and that's over 6 years. There's a Grow Your Own program. That was the school districts that help paras to Minneapolis. Minneapolis was one of the grant recipients to get paraprofessionals into teaching positions. So that was $1.5 million. Full-service community schools, where there's, I believe, have been 13 overall participants. That was $1 million. There was broadband expansion for students. I know Representative Kreisha, who's not here, but I'd like to give him some kudos, carried that bill. That was $500,000. The much-needed staff development level 4 setting grants a lot of intermediates were received this funding. That's $4.5 million. There's two grants under positive behavioral interventions and supports. One is for $750,000. One is for $2 million. As I mentioned, the agricultural educator grants, that's $250,000. Teacher governed grants that I also mentioned is $500,000. That doesn't cover all the other ones that are named grants, but again, I can provide that information, the amounts with the list I provide of the new grants, and then we can also provide the amounts for the grants that have already been existing.
Right, and just to shed a little light, because you weren't on the committee last year, Representative Thiessen, as part of the supplemental budget, we went through a process where, and I won't go through the description unless people want it, and I'll turn to Mr. Strom, something called maximum effort loans that were made from the state to school districts, and we offered an opportunity for school districts to repay those loans and get out from under that financing. That resulted in one-time money coming into the state, and so because it was one-time money, there were probably a much higher number than usual grants provided in that supplemental budget because, it was one-time money.
And just one follow-up then.
Representative Thiessen.
So when the money runs out, what happens, and is there like reporting back on how these are doing? Like, is the idea that if some do well, we can fund them in the future, or we just gave the money one time just to help out particular school districts or particular programs?
I'll call him department first, but I will say sort of the philosophy with many of those grants that we funded were small pilots to see how something would work. I'll give you one example, and because it happened to be a bill that Representative Seltzer authored, but I co-authored with her, something called Rock and Read. It's a program that helps struggling readers, usually beyond third grade. It's often fourth, fifth, and sixth grade that uses music, and somehow that helps unlock the code for some children. So I think that was maybe $100,000. It was a fairly small pilot, and with the idea being, let's see how it works. We'll bring them in to show their results. I've actually met with them already, and they're doing great things in four schools. But the idea of measuring the results of that to see if it would be something we could roll out to additional schools. But I'll call in the department if you want to make any comments about any of the grants or.
Thank you, Representative and Representative Thiessen. I would simply say that in terms of what happens when the grant is over is really up to the legislature. Some of the grants do have an evaluation component and some do not. I know that some of the grantees already have advocates. I know Representative Tice has introduced a bill for the Santa Foundation. There are others who are looking to continue the work. And so it's really, each were fairly unique, and so in terms of what happens, it will be up to the legislature or it will be up to the entities to determine how they want to secure funding to continue what may be promising.
Thank you. Representative Sandstedt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, I'm going to go back to something you mentioned very early on in your presentation when you were talking about specialists that you have at the department, and you mentioned you had no art specialist. And I was going to be quiet, but your comment kind of makes me want to ask this. Why not?
Commissioner Briner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative. I think the question, why not, would be illustrated by the reduced funding and the flat funding that we've had over time. And so we have to make difficult choices every day, and I think that it's fair to say that the absence of an art specialist or a music specialist or a counselor in the department is something we feel acutely in terms of gaps in service we're able to provide.
Representative Sandstedt. Thank you. Yet we are still expected to fulfill, not just me, but any kind of an art teacher in any of the areas, state and national standards. So I think more than anything, I just want to make the comment that it would be very helpful to have that position reinstated. Thank you.
Thank you. And Representative Mariani.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so back to the grant question. It seemed to me, there's some really important questions here, but it seemed to me that the part of the point of the testimony here is, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that it costs money to administer grants. And I could certainly hold up that over years I've done grants where I didn't pay attention to that fact, and then I get a an earful from the commissioner afterwards. but I think it's actually important for us to know that. And so, what is the capacity, the status, the impact of the department to be able to do this? Are we appropriating? Are we negotiating out appropriate levels for the department to then carry out the will of the legislature relative to these grants?
Deputy Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative Mariani, thank you for the question. I think it's a fair one. I think that it, I don't have a magic number for you, but I can tell you that often administrative, when we look at federal grants, there is perhaps 5% that's allowed for administrative costs. Mm-hmm. In a grant, and so that you know that you can work within that amount to actually do the work of administering the grant, monitoring, evaluating, providing assistance. In terms of our capacity, we make tough choices every day, and it's difficult because it's not as if we can just pull a psychometrician out of assessment to go work in our grants division, or an auditor from Dr. Melcher's shop, or a reading specialist. It's not necessarily an interchangeable dynamic. There's highly specialized skills and knowledge needed to administer a grant or to be an academic standards specialist. Mm-hmm. And so because of the quick turnaround of some of the grants, we really didn't have time or the resources to bring on additional staff. So it forces us into some pretty difficult situations. Our people are tired. They're doing a lot of work, and oftentimes they're doing more with less. They're remarkable public servants, and I would be remiss if I didn't acknowledge that with all of you. They're doing really good work because they're committed to children and teachers. In terms of how we best make sure that we have the capacity to do that, I think that there are ways to look at that based on how other grants are administered. So, for example, as I mentioned, the federal grants, which would allow for 5%. I know that some state grants and other committees allow that sort of consideration for administration costs.
Thank you.
All right. We're running, short of time. So I'm going to let you highlight what you'd like to from your presentation, because we probably can't get through the whole thing, and I apologize for that. We're a question-filled group, and I think that's a good thing. So,
thank you, Madam Chair, and I appreciate the questions as well and the ability to make the case and dig deeply into this. I'm going to go quickly through the rationale for the governor's budget recommendations. Impacts to agency operating costs, as I mentioned, there are drivers beyond our control. We have fixed costs in the lease. We have a building that we leased in 2008. So that it's a 10-year lease that was negotiated in 2008, which calls for a 3% increase in our rent each year. That equates to $90,000 a year. Other operating increases in enterprise initiatives from professional development for staff, professional development and training, diversity and recruiting efforts to make sure that we are accurately reflecting Minnesota's population, employee safety perception, surveys and plans, sustainability efforts, and other initiatives that are coming throughout the enterprise which have a cost attached that we are not able to consider discretionary. We have an increase to operating costs for minute services, which includes compensation increases for staff, funding to main systems that were built with federal funds that are no longer available, such as ECLDS, which gives us really good information about the various programs and services provided to young children and their families, operating costs, filling and maintaining positions. School funding and student data, we mentioned the mainframe earlier, $3.2 million to upgrade the mainframe. Commissioner France and Commissioner Baden testified in another committee just a few days ago that a system that was built in 1974 when Commissioner France was still in high school probably should be considered too old when we're talking about distributing 40% of the state budget. Impacts to agency operating costs, increased compensation costs and cost of living adjustments, which have been negotiated in our labor agreements, and maintaining our data analytics team. As I mentioned, As I mentioned, that small but mighty team is being funded with some federal funding that's going away. We would like to be able to at least maintain the existing levels of support that that team provides. And then, as you also are aware, pension cost increases impact MDE. Many of you may not be aware of the fact that teachers who come to work at the department can choose to stay in TRA, and so those pension increases have an impact on our agency operating costs. Legal costs. I think this is important to spend just a minute on. As you know, we have two major lawsuits that the state is defending right now, the Forslund case on teacher tenure and Cruz Guzman on integration. In addition to standard legal costs, defending a major lawsuit includes depositions, mediation, outside counsel, and a number of other costs. So the Attorney General's office has told us to expect, over the course of the next biennium, $1.2 million in additional legal costs to defend those major suits. That's in line with what we've seen in other agencies to defend major suits. And then $800,000 a year is just our standard legal cost. The Attorney General's office has gone to a rate payment or a fee-for-service billing model, which has substantially increased our anticipated legal costs just for everyday consultation and service. And then I just
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You don't have staff attorneys? You don't have people on staff?
Commissioner Penner. Madam Chair and Representative, we have a number of staff who are attorneys, but we do not have in-house counsel.
Interesting. Okay. Thank you.
And so I thank you, Representative. I just wanted to summarize by saying, I'm not at the summary yet. There's also an ask, a request in the governor's budget to expand our capacity. So you've heard me talk a lot about the work that we do to support educators and schools and students. And so the governor's request also requests $720,000 that would allow us to increase our staff levels by 5 full-time employees to provide a variety of services and supports.
And Commissioner, Representative Juergens has a question before I go to that. So those 5 professional, will those be part of the regional center structure or something else?
Thank you, Representative. Without getting too specific, because again, depending on the needs of the agency, I think that there is clearly a desire to do more through the regional centers based on the demand. Also in data analytics, certainly there's a lot of demand for that kind of expertise. We know we have needs in Indian education and other areas, and then with some of the specialized areas of support. We heard questions about why we don't have an art specialist, so we would like to assess where the need and the demand really lie.
Thank you. Representative Juergens, and we'll let you be the last question today.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I know we don't have time to get into it today, but at some point I would like more information on the compensation increase, which just looking at it looks to be about a 60% increase from just over 1.047 to 1.646.
Thank you. On the last chart, I think on your is that the one you're referring to, the last chart on this?
Yes, it says governor's recommendations, cost for overview, compensation increase, and there's another slide on it here on page 8 as well.
Thank you. Commissioner, do you want to make any comment on that?
Madam Chair and Representative, the only thing that I would say is that those increases are actually agreed upon in labor negotiations with the state, with each of the bargaining units, so that's a driver beyond our control.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. All right. I'm sorry we are really out of time. Any last comments, Deputy Commissioner? And we appreciate you spending time with us today.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. The only comment I would make is thank you for your thoughtful attention. We welcome additional questions. We'd be happy to come back if you have more information, and we'll be happy to follow up with the questions that we weren't able to provide today.
All right. Well, thank you very much. I know we did ask for a few things through the course of the questions, which I know you will send us as you're able. But with that, I thank the members and Mr. Uni and Deputy Commissioner Greiner. Again, thanks for being with us. Committee is adjourned.